Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup, we're going to be taking a look at three questions we've been hearing from international educators this past week. It's been an interesting news week. We'll get to those stories in just a few minutes and how they're going to impact our field in the days and weeks and months to come. But we're also going to take some time before we start today's episode to welcome those that are new to the Roundup. Thank you for joining us. This is always a lively chat each Wednesday afternoon at 1 p.m. Eastern, where we get a chance to dive into not just the news stories of the day, but how these news stories impact our field and some solutions, perhaps, where there are issues on how we can best navigate these ever-changing waters in our field. As those who have been with us for a while know, we take the three topics that we cover on the Roundup from news themes that we've covered in our newsletter that comes out on Mondays each week, 9 a.m. Eastern. We send that free newsletter out to any who are signed up, and we cover wide-ranging topics in social media and international education, and oftentimes where those two intersect. And that newsletter is free of charge and available to any who would like to find it at smieconsulting.org/subscribe. You can also find an archive of past issues there, where it presents just our quick takes on the top news stories of the week. And then every Wednesday, we take three of those themes that we've seen throughout news stories and news events that have happened, and focus on an evaluation of those for international educators. So today, we're going to be starting off with an important topic related to probably one of the bigger news stories of the week as far as international education goes, and that is ICE's or DHS's overall and ICE's specific plot ironically named move, the optical illusion or OPTical illusion. And this is an attempt to go after students who are working illegally in what they call jobs not directly related to their academic programs. They also went after 15 and had documented 15 arrests of international students that were working for companies that do not exist. And that led to, during the press conference that announced this optical illusion of those that are working without working or are shown to be in status working at jobs that do not exist. There is, during that press conference, Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Ken Cuccinelli is quoted as saying, "One of the most un-American things I can think of is an employer who's depriving qualified Americans of work while filling that job with a foreign national who does not qualify." And the whole premise of this attack, there are multi-layers to it, but the first of which was these about 1,100 students or so who were violating the terms of their immigration status and whose work permits that their status students were being revoked. I said that there are 700 of these 1,100 were in violation because failing to report an employer within 121 days or by failing to obtain employment. So this was the reason that they were determined to be out of status, that they either failed to report an employer that they were working but not, they hadn't reported it, hadn't gone into the CVS portal to do that, or within failing to obtain employment. So one of those two possibilities is for the lion's share of these students that were not able to find employment, and that approximately 400 students are due to expire within the next 2 months. Well, that's only a natural rate of attrition for students as they come off OPT. So, but the rest of the 15 international students who claim to be employed by companies that do not exist is one that caught Secretary Cuccinelli in some remarks he made, basically saying that it's un-American for employers to deprive qualified Americans of work while filling that job with a foreign national who does not qualify. This is for those 15 students that were arrested for jobs at companies that did not exist. Does he think we're stupid, Secretary Cuccinelli? I ask you this. Are these students that are working for fictional companies taking jobs that don't exist from Americans that might be qualified for also jobs that don't exist? I can think of a few government jobs that I question whether they actually exist or not, but people are in them and probably getting paid very well for doing them. So I'm curious as to, obviously this move, the timing is certainly in line with a lot of the other moves this administration has made, particularly through DHS, through some of their H-1B rulings, and particularly the ban that came in place in June that has led to a $100 billion loss to our economy by employers not being able to bring in qualified applicants for jobs, universities not being able to hire professors, groups of universities are also taking the government to court for. But you look at some of this, the groups that are identified in this, you have the 1,100 students that were violating terms of their immigration status, and that 700 were having their immigration status revoked because they hadn't reported an employer within 121 days or by failing to obtain employment. And that was written into the rule that in the past, OPT, if you didn't get employed, there wasn't really a clock running on you once you got approved for OPT to get a job. You could legally stay in status for the entire term of your OPT plus 60 days afterwards, which you'd legally be entitled to do after a program end date, 14 months if it's a one-year OPT, 38 months if it's STEM OPT, to leave the country or change status or move to a new program. So that rule was put in place, actually, a rule was put in place during the Obama administration that did put a clock on it, you had to, within 4 months, within 120 days, you had to report, be gainfully employed in your field of study. That's the requirement of OPT, obviously. And this is now, these students that are now out of status as a result had not been able to find employment, basically, or failed to report employment if they did have it. So there's that group, there's the group of the 15 that were arrested for jobs that don't exist. And that's obviously a very small microcosm. Even the 1,100 is a small microcosm, less than 0.5% of the total number of students that are on OPT in the country. In 2018-19, that number was 223,000 students. So with 1,100 of that, that's less than 0.5%. Were in this status where they failed to achieve, be employed or report employment within 121 days of being approved for their OPT status. So, and if they are, what ICE is moving into now is a field that in the past, employers or universities really had no role in determining whether a student could work at a particular job if they were offered after graduation OPT. It was just reported through, and only recently within the last year or two, as to who they were working for. Was that even managed in CBIS? Previously, that had not been a requirement at all, and it has become pretty much a self-report by students to, because of the Obama administration rule, within 120 days of their employment authorization, they have to show that they are employed. So that is certainly one part of the puzzle here. But what this is doing is now DHS is saying, or ICE in particular, is saying that if the work that they are doing is far afield from that field of study, they are not qualifying for the work permits. They're not qualified to stay in the United States. And that's what they're policing. In Australia, in the UK, in Canada, these such tight regulations on our interpretations of regulations do not exist to this extent. That students, if they get a job, they wouldn't be hired if they could, typically you would think, if they didn't have the qualifications for the job, particularly when companies must demonstrate when they're hiring international students that There weren't other qualified applications, certainly for the H-1B, that's the case. But for any institution or any organization that hires an international student, there's obviously extra things that they need to do, E-Verify and all. They have to deal with any student really now, or any applicant in almost all cases. So, but now ICE is saying that if an international student who's graduated with a degree gets hired by a company, they are now making the determination, ICE is, if they get that job, which many international students that don't have a whole lot of choice, that they're hoping for that one job that they can take after they graduate to work and start getting practical experience. And they don't come to this country trying to get jobs in fields that are not related to their field of study. It's just not clear. I know that there are students that were just, once they got approved, they got a business degree and they went into working for a hotel or working for, if they're not a hospitality management, or if you're working for a hotel, that might not be appropriate anymore in this current interpretation of ICE. Or you're running the books you have a business degree, but you're running the books, or you're doing marketing for a business. Does that count? ICE's interpretation is tending towards it probably doesn't count. And they're becoming employment experts, apparently, and as to what degrees prepare students for. And anyone that's worked on a college campus, particularly liberal arts college campuses in the United States, knows that if you're a history major, your jobs that you get aren't going to be necessarily history related. I was a history poli-sci major. I went into college admissions and then international admissions and international education. Those weren't majors that prepared me for it. In terms of if I was an international student and I wanted to do a job in international education, not being a DSO at this point, but if I wanted to be a university recruiter, what degree prepares you for that? And OPT is the pathway for an international student to continue if they want to stay at a university, eventually maybe get to H-1B, but they could work for a university on OPT. But under this new immigration regulations, liberal arts majors wouldn't qualify for any particular jobs unless it's teaching history or studying history or researching history. And there's a whole lot of those jobs out there. Political scientist, unless you're going into politics, can you really... Are there going to be jobs for you? So what ICE is moving into, what DHS is moving into when it comes to things international are the narrowest possible definition or interpretation of a definition of work of international students and that type of thing. So it's really frustrating, obviously, for international educators when they see this. Well, this isn't even the most galling thing about what this new move, optical illusion, is targeting, because you look at some of the words used in the course of the press briefing on this, is that they are now also targeting DSOs, and that DSOs, according to Assistant Secretary Cuccinelli, says that are engaged in willful ignorance or a level of negligence, that's a quote, willful ignorance or a level of negligence in placing international students in optional practical training programs. And let's just stop for a minute. First of all, OPT is not a placement position or function of the university. The university is not hiring these students. The university is not placing these students. That's CPT potentially. There's certainly a lot more institutional control over CPT. That the universities do not have a direct role in placing students at jobs. Particularly DSOs do not have that responsibility in placing students in OPT jobs. That is up to the students. Certainly institutions have career services, professional development offices that help students interview, prepare the resumes, and that type of thing. But there is a disconnect there because there is not certainly a legal requirement as far as the immigration regulations for institutions to be placing or institutions to be regulating. But when students apply to Citizenship and Immigration Services, they do not have jobs yet, typically, because they're still finishing their degree, most of them, and they're planning their timing of these their jobs, jobs that they could be eligible for after they graduate. And they can't obviously, they could start after they graduate. Before they graduate if they finish their coursework. But the reality is these students are asking for permission to work, and then hoping once they get the permission, if it comes in a timely manner, which right now it hasn't been coming in a timely manner. You can only apply 60 days before you wish to start your job, and the processing time is often 2 to 3 months minimum for OPT applications, sometimes more. There's always backlogs over the summer when CIS is swamped with applications each year for OPT and other things. So these students are put in a bind where they don't have a job at the time. They're asking for permission to work for that year, which is their right in terms of the responsibilities or rights and responsibilities they have as international students. Is they have a year, if they're not a STEM major, to do work permission, to receive work authorization to work in their field. Yes, it has to be in your field. Directly related is the phrasing that's used for CPT, but that seems to be more extended to OPT now as well. But the DHS Assistant Secretary here, Ken Cuccinelli, is now saying that DSOs are either willfully negligent or willfully ignorant, or just demonstrating a level of negligence in their responsibilities. First, that's just clear misunderstanding or wrong interpretation of what the regulations actually require of DSOs. Again, the work reporting requirement of actually saying what jobs they do get is up to the student. It's self-reported. But now, and Cuccinelli is actually talking about sanctioning these DSOs, removing them as DSOs from their institutions. So these threats to terminate DSOs for violating a duty that is not theirs to begin with, it's exceptionally punitive. And that can impact, obviously, the institutions that they work for, ability to continue to enroll these students in the future. So Esther Brimmer at NAFSA, the CEO there, came up with a very forceful statement. And she calls it an unsubstantiated and reckless attack on key members of the higher ed community who are working to support the 1 million international students that are currently in the country. So the government is, it's nothing surprises us anymore as international educators, but this is really what we might have felt in the past with a lot of these attacks and proposals, that this was really an indirect assault on us and our profession as international educators in the U.S. This is quite clearly a threat to DSOs in particular, who have advisory responsibilities for international students, that you could potentially lose your job or your ability to be a DSO or an RO at your institution. So clearly, it's bridge too far for a lot of international educators. So a lot of the Facebook groups I've seen where this topic has come up, they're apoplectic about this, and they are just feeling like the weight of the world is on their shoulders, and rightly so. This is obviously everything with the pandemic, with the election, and all the assaults on what we do in international education. This is pushing it a bit too far. Now is becoming much more personal. If it wasn't already, it is now. For a lot of those of us in international education who have had this experience as DSOs. So my thoughts and prayers go out to all of you that are in those positions on campus. And obviously the lion's share of less than 0.5% of those students that are on OPT were targeted by this attack, and primarily because they haven't been able to find a job. And in the middle of a pandemic, if they were just looking for employment over the last 4 months and they weren't able to find it, they're going to be thrown out of status, and just adding insult to injury to those students who are finishing their degrees, looking for work. Is there any surprise in that? And to not have the compassion to not be so forceful in the implementation or enforcement of these regulations, it's not surprising, but it's a new level of low by this administration, and one that we can't end soon enough as far as I'm concerned. So enough on the first topic. That's a big one there. Obviously, it's thrown a lot of us for a loop this past week. Shifting gears now, we'll talk about how valuable is Education USA. And I say this as a former, in all truth in advertising, as a former not employed by IIE in Washington, D.C., as from 2008 to 2014 as the first Education USA marketing and outreach coordinator, working for the U.S. State Department, ECA, and the Education USA branch, as it was later become named, in promoting Education USA. So it's very much a part of who I am and was even before I started working for them. Back in 2008, Education USA advisors had always been a part of my life, professional life, as resources, as experts in the field, on the ground support when I travel. If I'm getting to know an education system or school, they would be there to help me. But they have become great personal friends in many places around the world. Whenever I travel abroad again, certainly anytime I did in the past, I always made it a point to visit Education USA centers and meet with advisors, even those advisors that have gone on to do bigger and better things. Always made it a point to involve them in what I do because, as my first international ed boss said, they're going to become your best friends and best resources in the field because of who they are and what they do on the ground. They are the And oftentimes the most selfless people in their field, working in jobs and for employers, whether it's through a Fulbright commission, a binational, a center, a university library, or an embassy or consulate as a local hire. They are oftentimes not the best paid staff, but they have the biggest hearts for their students that they advise. And so as a resource just for the advisors alone, they are a must-have, as far as I'm concerned, for any international admissions person. They also provide incredible resources. I know one of the things that has come out this year that we pioneered back in 2010, we launched the first global guide when we also did the first Education USA Forum, is the Education USA Global Guide. This is the 2020 edition, posting the link to that in the comments section. They do this annually. It's a great report that gives high-level trends, a lot of the kind of interpretation of the Open Doors numbers and other on-the-ground resources that the advisors have that perhaps university folks wouldn't have themselves to get to know what's going on and what the trends are, what social media platforms students are using, how students are connecting in their country with educational advising. What they like to see, what topics they're hearing, what majors their students are likely to do. So it's a fantastic resource. And as far I've always said, since this was launched in 2010, this is if Open Doors is your first go-to resource for like data, the Gold Global Guide is kind of the interpretation of that data. It has to be one A in terms of the references and resources that you use as an international educator. Our international admissions representative. Education USA, this is also topical because it was released last week as part of their Education USA virtual forum. Normally they were planning to meet in person in October in D.C., but decided to shift online. It was originally pushed from summer in person to October in person, and then switched to online in late September. To a fully online event, and it was for me great. Always a pleasure to reconnect with the advisors. Even though I'm not directly doing international admissions work myself, I work for universities that are putting together plans and developing resources and strategies to reach students in particular markets. This global guide is essential and has to be a part of that process. So I always encourage my university and college clients, this needs to be a part of what you and your staff read, and that as you formulate plans, it's a great resource to help give you the scope of knowledge you need about a particular destination, region or market or country. What they've done is also this year, which I think is just absolutely perfect timing for this, they also put together a COVID supplement to the Global Guide, and that had some great recommendations for website policy, regarding policy changes that might happen, new admissions criteria where there are changes made. Maybe you eliminated SAT, ACT, GRE, GMAT, and that you have maybe offered other alternatives for English proficiency demonstration. That if they're STEM fields, there may be questions about online education, and you'll need to kind of talk about that environment for your for the particularly now during COVID and about what that looks like. They talk about all the virtual events that they're doing. They've had regional fairs, virtual fairs that have been free for universities to participate in, that have drawn 20,000 plus each of these regional fairs over the last few months. The exceptional volume, and certainly institutions certainly appreciate the kind of attention that gives them. So. It also focuses on some themes that we talk about here on the Roundup all the time, and I certainly talk about with my clients on the university side, is highlighting your current students and recent graduates in your messaging, persona marketing, to have a country-level marketing that includes messages from students, from alumni, and you incorporate that messaging throughout your communication flow with students over the course of the life cycle of a prospect to enrolled student. So there's some great data in here, and it also gives some regional highlights too on how COVID's impacting the region and how institutions can be better positioned to reach those students. It also talks about showing how you're handling COVID on your campuses, because frankly, that makes a difference. We know the U.S. has not handled COVID well as a whole, but there are great examples of institutions around the country that have had such a well-thought-out and constructed plan in place to manage it, to manage the health and safety of their students by regular testing, contact tracing, social distancing, masks, all of that, and have that be enforced regularly, that have had very few, if any, cases on their campuses, which is remarkable in this climate that we're in the U.S. We're in our third wave of cases here in the U.S., but some colleges are really showing an incredible grasp of the issue, and I think are well situated to help be great examples for future students that might be looking to come in, because this pandemic has thrown the whole world off kilter, and it's going to have a longer lasting effects than we've ever thought it might have been. Where maybe we were hoping in the spring we'll start get back to international travel. I'm not counting on that till spring of 2022 more than anything else. I think 2021 is going to be shot completely for recruitment travel. So making those changes to what we do and to how we present ourselves to students is not something we're just thinking about for this fall. It has to be something that we're putting in front of students and their parents who are obviously inclined to be more concerned now with a global pandemic than ever before. So it's really EDUSA for me is still the best resource you can have as part of your international enrollment planning and recruitment strategies. And so if you aren't already, you should be using them as international admissions reps in the U.S. And finally, we're going to talk about a somewhat related topic, but certainly one that we don't focus on much as far as ourselves go. And this is an article I just finished for IDP Connect, and it's called International Admissions Self-Care for Our Pandemic-Infused Lives. And it talks about a lot of what we are the transition to our work, particularly those on institutional campuses, what that has looked like, those that have been road warriors in the past, having now your emotional baggage that you have to leave at home, that is so used to traveling with you around the world, it's now got a sad face emoji on it permanently because it hasn't been taken out of the closet in months. Beyond that, it's also what the impact of our work days looks like as international admissions reps. That's normally 20-hour work days on the road when you're traveling overseas is normal, and the flights and the traffic and the waiting in lines, the hotel check-ins and counters, taxi stands, is now replaced by 10 to 12 Zoom visits a day at different schools or agencies or Education USA events. Having done both in my life, when you think about what's a more taxing day on you, certainly I've had folks that have posted normally road warriors are now posting their Zoom schedules online as examples of what they're doing every day. And it's just phenomenal how they're able to fit all this in, and certainly working well outside those normal work hours, and are doing all hours of the day and night doing these events virtually around the world. So, and I asked what's more tiring, and I would hazard a guess that most people are more tired with the with the Zoom life than they would be with the travel. Because at least the travel, there's that sense of excitement necessarily when you're traveling, particularly to places you haven't been before, and that kind of is that adrenaline can keep you going through a lot of that. But the downtime is much different now than it is was previously, and balance and time, home life balance and flexibility and just a sense of well-being is under threat because of such a radical shift for many of us from what our lives used to be. So planning your time, setting and maintaining work, personal life boundaries, getting outside, these are just some of the things that I focus on with what you need to do in terms of your own just physical health and mental health, but also maximizing your impact and what can you do to really push the boat out a little bit and really see how you can manage your time effectively. And by instead of doing 100 individual high school visits, trying to do fairs like through Education USA and other vendors, taking advantage of webinars, looking at teaming up with colleagues from other like-minded institutions, your state, there are state consortia that have been doing this well. Study Illinois, Study Texas have arranged virtual events. Illinois is doing graduate fair actually last week, and Study Texas is doing a full fair for their members to connect with students in November. So there's a lot of great events like that and great examples of what you can be doing to maximize your impact instead of trying to individually as an institution rep bang your head against the door there. So self-care also is important for us just on a professional level is making sure that you're maintaining your contact with peers, sharing your stories, but also on the campus level, it's caring for your students because they are why you do what you do. And our current students, particularly those that didn't go home over when the pandemic hit in the spring, are perhaps the most vulnerable that have been here stranded away from family and unable to have the regular contact that they need with colleagues and classmates. So making sure that you're checking in with them and there's plans in place to do that on your campus, I think is so very important for their care as well, not just your own. And I think that's something that we certainly should not be missed through all of this. So quite a bit to chew on over the next few days from these topics, and we invite you to share your comments and suggestions here on the Roundup for future topics you'd like to hear about, but certainly we'll cover those and more in every edition. So thanks very much for being a part of the Roundup today, and we look forward to connecting with you in the future. Cheers.